Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. This week, and it's an election special. Firstly, Laura Welty from Bristol Disability and Equality Forum, asking how the election will affect the disabled. Also, child stealing by the state and institutional child sexual abuse. Is that on the election agenda for the party leaders? It doesn't seem it is. So we talk to Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Elect a president and he's killed by his own security forces. The JFK killer, James Files, explains how President Kennedy would not have been killed in Dallas if it was raining. Also, about the man who shot JFK dead, the CIA tried to kill him and failed. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, I'll read out contact details at the end of the show.
Hello, this is Arabella, and today I'm speaking to Laura from the Bristol Disability Equality Forum. And hi there. And I just wanted to see if you'd like to introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do and the background of the forum and how it came about.
Okay. First of all, my name's Laura Welty, and I'm the manager of Bristol Disability Equality Forum. And we're an organisation led by disabled people looking to ensure the voice and influence of disabled people, regardless of any what their impairment is or any diagnosis they've been given. So we cover the deaf community, people with physical or sensory or mental health or neurodiverse differences to the mainstream. And our work really involves a lot of campaigning, a fair amount of lobbying for change, and for supporting and advising various services and organisations to be as inclusive as they can be, and in particular, capitalise on what disabled people have to offer the city.
Mm, okay. And how many people are in your organisation? How many people can you reach out to, and how many people does it actually actively participate?
Right. We probably have about around about 40 or 50 regular involved members who come to our open events and things like that. We have around 250 on our mailing list. But we also have several hundred via Facebook. We have a lot of connections with other groups and individuals, and have various people visiting the website. And, right, of course, we never quite know where they're from and so on.
So it's
but the vast majority of our Facebook people are from this area.
Okay. So it's quite a wide network of support that...
Yes, and we're plugged into a lot of other organisations as well, and so we're able to reach out to and draw in their members.
Fantastic. Okay. And the general elections are coming up soon. Could you tell me a little bit about how you think you might be affected, what you'd like for the best outcome to be, what do you think maybe the negative sides of the election will be affecting your community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, there are so many different interests that people have beyond their identity as a disabled person, that, you know, everybody will have their different view about who they should vote to and what the biggest pluses and minuses of the manifestos are. But from the disability perspective, the big one that's come up is the issue of social care. Mm. There is a real problem with social care, and I would suggest anyway that the kind of discussions that have happened at a national politics level really focus purely as though the issue was just older people getting older and acquiring impairments. And that's important because their economic solutions that they're proposing for it, no account of the idea of disabled people also being in that, being affected. I'll give you an example. The previous Labour government talked about bringing in a cap where you would get insurance that would pay for the first £70,000 of your social care needs, and then the state would pay for the rest. Well, if you're born a disabled person, who's going to insure you? Right. Well, no one's going to, are they? Because it's a guaranteed cert that you'll need support. Similarly, this issue around now saying, well, even if you live in your own home, you're now going to have to effectively mortgage that to a local authority,
yes,
if you want to stay living in it, to meet your social care. Well, again, that's not going to work if someone is going to be needing social care support for several decades rather than several years.
And as you said, you feel that in general the focus is more on the elderly disabled people rather than the wider picture of all the different disabilities that there are out there.
I think they are, yes, they're focusing as though the problem was just a narrow, had a narrow focus.
Exactly.
And it doesn't. And none of it addresses the question of why exactly it is individuals should be penalised for becoming a disabled person. We don't financially penalise. We try very hard not to financially penalise people for being rich.
Yeah.
Why are we going to penalise them for being poor? Which is the case. I mean, some recent research found that pretty much half of the living in poverty in this country include at least one disabled person. You know, so whilst there will be variation, there are a lot of people living on or close to that poverty line. And what the government could be potentially about to do is create a policy whereby it makes more sense to keep your house mortgaged forever than it does to pay your mortgage off, which won't benefit government, the country, or the individual.
Does the forum come up with suggestions, more concrete suggestions of how these things could be solved on a short term and long term in terms of the politics and the structure and how are things set up? Because
to some extent we do. I mean, we do a lot of work trying to point out what prevention work could be done to stop people's need for support increasing as a way to lower costs. But we are a community of people of all political colours, but I think some form of central budget for paying it rather than individual budgets. Now, whether you get that through taxation of individuals or companies or goods or whatever, I think most of my members would agree that it is the sort of thing that should be financed in the way that the rest of our statutory services are.
So it's a lot about recognising how big the issue is actually and putting more effort into it than it has been for now. Okay.
And also a lot of the social, the support that people need, a lot of the social care bill is actually because we don't design an environment and a society that is accessible for disabled people.
Yeah.
You know, if, for example, we had accessible buses and accessible workplaces, etc., etc., you wouldn't have so many disabled people unemployed and living on benefits. You wouldn't need for access to work to pay for me to have a cab to go to work, you know, and so on. So there is a much bigger picture whereby you could design out the need for a lot of the social care support.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of it, because we will always sometimes need specific person doing something. But a lot of it could be designed out.
And you said something interesting, that the number of disabled people is rising.
Mm.
Is that the case? And if it yes. is, then why do you think that's happening?
Pressures on the two ends of the age spectrum, really. More people are surviving as children who have been born with very complex needs. So there are more people with more complex needs being born and surviving. And then you've got people living much longer at the other end. So they are also acquiring more impairments because they are around for longer and the body inevitably starts breaking down. And then there is this bit in the middle as well, I think, where the mental health end is particularly floated up to much higher visibility, and that is that the way we organise our society at the moment is creating huge amounts of stress on people, so that you have young people in school developing really bad mental health circumstances and self-harming and so on because of the pressures on them. You've got the issue around the automation of production and employment in the middle age, and so you go on. But all of it is kind of linked to, well, how do we organise ourselves to be as inclusive as possible and to prevent as much demand on our services as possible?
Mm. And you've mentioned the mental health issue a few times, and it's a lot of times it's separated. There's the mental health issue, which is one thing, and then you've got disability, which also encompasses quite a lot, but it does have it does seem to be two separate groups.
They has, I think, very often in the past been seen that way. Our philosophy is that what makes us disabled people is our environment and the attitudes around us. And we share that regardless of what our impairment is, whether that's physical, mental, whatever. And very often, certainly within my job, I notice that people's access needs don't along the lines of a particular diagnosis either. You can have a group of people with mental health through to a range of sensory and physical impairments who have a shared need that they don't necessarily have with the other people in their grouping.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I understand. So everything is basically connected to everything else. And
well,
it's difficult
that's maybe my own more personal philosophy coming
fore. But that does make a lot of sense to me. And can you tell us a little bit about the Disabled People's Manifesto and how that came about, and what's your aim with it?
Right. Well, the reason it came about is twofold, I think. One is that the Bristol City Council, who fund us, said, look, we'd quite like to know something that puts together what are the key issues that your community wants the wider city to address, not just the council. And our members wanted us to have something that we could clearly identify the different barriers that they face in different parts of their life. So we pulled together the various issues people had raised with us over the past few years. We researched exactly what the evidence is for some of these things as well. And then we had a very large event in the M Shed and invited disabled people to come along and say, did they think that what we'd put together was about right? Were there things missing? Were there things that used to be an issue, but actually they're not anymore? And what wasn't there at all? And then finally to say, well, as we can't put absolutely everything in the document, because you'd never get to the end of reading it. What are your priorities within this?
Right.
And we took all of that away and used it to pull together the manifesto. The manifesto.
And what will happen to the manifesto?
Right, well, we have drawn up a pledge for organisations to pledge to the manifesto. The manifesto itself is in sort of topic sections, if you will, and to try and make it easy for people to engage with, it comes as a double page spread. So you have an area like employment is one section, and it will go, these are some of the problems, and it will give you the sorts of issues that have arisen. And then the other page is, these are some of the things you can do about it. And it does that for employment, for housing, for education, for transport, for leisure and retail, for voice and influence, for social care, for health and for safety. So there will be some players for whom a few or even only one of these sections might be relevant.
Mm.
You know, say you're an employer and you make capacitors. So you might think, well, really, basically, the one we need to look at is the employment and maybe the education section. But housing's not our bag, so we won't have to bother with that. They then look at that. They decide what it is that they, how much they want to pledge to the manifesto. And they sign the pledge saying who they are, by what date they will have drawn up a work plan for implementing it, and the first thing that they were going to do, like the quick, easy win that they're going to implement straight away.
Mm.
And we will then annually review people's pledges' progress on that. We're very small. There's me, half-time, and there's 12 hours admin and an awful lot of trusty goodwill volunteering for things other than just being a trustee. So we've not been able to promote it as widely and fully as we would have liked at the moment because of limited time. But we have already got two or three large ish organisations committed to signing up to it, which we're very pleased about, and we're going to be working with them. One is Bristol Community Health.
Fantastic.
Another one is Bristol Energy. So you can see you go from health to very much what you would see as mainstream private sector business type thing.
And what do you think would help this manifesto become even more successful? I was just thinking about maybe an incentive, a government incentive, where they'd have to, other companies and organisations would have to take the manifesto and use it as an actual.
We're kind of hoping that we've made the case for why it's good to sign up to the manifesto within the document, in that I think particularly for an area like Bristol where tourism is such a big generator of income, you know, you are talking about potentially losing out on millions if not billions of pounds. And you do that because outside of the main chains, you can barely find an accessible hotel in the city.
Right, yeah.
The money that the hotel chains earn tends to go out of the city.
Mm.
So it's really important that most of those tourism-dependent businesses need to up their game a bit around accessibility. And that's not just because we are 20-25% of the population.
Mm.
But actually, at the moment, the greatest disposable income are the ones who are starting to acquire impairments because they are the retirement age, early retirement age group. And they are spending the most money, and they are the ones that are going to find themselves suddenly not being catered for now that they have one or two access needs.
I understand.
So there is that. But we also make the point, for example, in employment, that all the research shows that the most effective business is one where there is a diversity within their teams. And that, in particular, means a diversity in the way of thinking.
Yeah.
So people who are neurodiverse, people with dyslexia and so on, are actually an enhancement to your team, not a liability.
Yeah, definitely. And if we sort of magnify it onto the people of Bristol, the Bristolians, what would you like for the community more as a whole to be better at regarding disabled people, or just being sensitive to anybody who's not necessarily a conventional person?
I think probably two things. One is attitudinal. You know, sadly, there's been a lot of talking about what a liability disabled people are, one way or another, over the past few years. And there's been a direct relation between the amount of scroungers kind of publicity that there's been and increases in disability hate crime. Mm-hmm. And that is really noticeable. I mean, even, a week and a half ago, someone called out really loudly as I left a cafe on Stokes Croft, "I hope you need that." For those of you who are listening, I'm in a wheelchair. "I hope you need that and you're not just pretending," they said.
Wow.
And they wouldn't leave it at that. They kept shouting again and again on me as I was off down the street trying to get a response.
Right.
And I ended up having to go back to them, have a word, and they still went on and on and on.
Right.
So there's that kind of thing. But I think the answer to that is, again, you are an individual. Treat everybody else like they are as well, and value the fact that you're all different and that you all have got different needs and different interests and different perspectives.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I have to say I do get a bit fed up with is the kind of way that anything that's about accommodating disabled people is seen as an added extra if you've got nothing better to spend your money on.
Yeah.
So a building earlier today, somebody said, "Oh, I'm sorry, it's not accessible, but it's an old building and we don't have the money for whatever." And you go, well, yeah, but if it was preventing women going in.
Yeah.
Or the BME community or children or whatever.
Yeah.
Would you be as laid back about it as that? Mm. You know, surely it's all, what you should be doing is going like, this building isn't serving its purpose, so we'll wait until we can get a building that does.
Okay.
If we can't afford to make it accessible, then let's look for one that's already accessible.
Yeah.
And some of the most right-on groups and organisations are appalling in that regard.
Yeah.
So I think there's something for everybody to learn. It's not just about big business and government and so on.
Yeah.
It's actually about all of us.
Yeah. It starts within, I guess, and then it needs to kind of develop. And just to finish off, could you tell us one of your proudest moments in the forum, or a success story, something more specific? Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're doing really good work, but if you could just, I don't know, shed us light on something particularly
interesting. I'd say actually, I'm feeling like we've had quite a few successes recently. I think probably on a personal level, one of my proudest moments in my job, and certainly I would, when I look back on it, consider it was a good achievement, was that we managed to get the City Council to agree that all of its Bristol Impact Fund grants could only be used by organisations who were going to make their service accessible.
Mm.
And that is arguably a first in the country, potentially.
Well done.
That there is a pot of money there and it says, no, absolute, you have to sign up that you're going to be accessible, otherwise you don't even qualify to be considered for the money.
Mm.
So that I'm really pleased with. Of late, I've been very pleased that the Council Cabinet accepted our comments that it made no sense to make all the cuts to the concessionary travel cards that people have. And there were three cuts for that. There was going to be not subsidising services before 9:30, not actually providing bus passes for companions anymore, which would have hit people with mental health difficulties hugely, as well as those with learning difficulties and other neurodiversity. And the third one was that they weren't going to reimburse for travel and transport.
Mm.
They agreed to drop all three of those.
Wow,
after
fantastic.
We spoke to them about that. Not bad, is it?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And the third most recent one is that council's going to bring in prepaid cards, which are a bit like having a debit card for people on social care who want to manage their own support.
Okay.
And it was going to be obligatory that you use these prepaid cards. And we've got them to agree that people need to have choice. So now they will be able to choose to do things as they have been doing them or to switch to the card, whatever they prefer.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that the amount of money that they can keep for kind of emergencies, as were, staff going off sick, suddenly needing to buy cover and that amount of money will be directly relevant to what their support needs are. Whereas up till now, for the whole history of direct payments, it's always been just an arbitrary set amount of time. So you can have 1 month, 2 months, 3 months or whatever. But now that will be as personalised as your actual care plan is as well.
Brilliant.
So those, I think, are pretty good.
Well,
but the members are the best.
Okay.
Because it's them that did things like get the council to say, OK, you can have a choice about the cards. I have learnt so much from learning from other people.
Yeah.
They are what drives this organisation and we would achieve nothing without them.
Wow. It sounds like a strong community. It sounds like a good place to be. Well, thank you very much for all your hard work and thank you very much for taking the time and coming in to chat with me today.
Thank you.
And I look forward to hearing more about you and what you're doing and I wish you all the success for the future.
Thank you. Well, if you're from a equalities community, come along to our equalities election hustings on the 31st of May. It's if you contact Bristol DEF, which is all one word, @gmail.com to book a place. We are having the parties come there, a representative from each, and there's going to be tables for each of the equalities communities, and they will go round and say what they are going to do for your equalities community, and you will have a chance to then ask them questions about that. And we're doing that in partnership with the other organisations like ourselves that are for the other equalities communities, so like BME Voice, Multi-Faith Forum, Older People's Forum, LGBT Bristol, and the Women's Forum, and ourselves, Bristol Disability Equality Forum.
And that's happening on...
That's happening 11 till 1 on the 31st of May, and it's going to be in the Fielden Theatre at the City Academy in Redfield.
Fantastic. And could you just repeat the website once more?
The website is www.bristoldef.org. bristol.org.uk, but the email for booking your place is bristoldef@gmail.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined on the line by Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Hi, Sabine.
Hi, Tony.
Well, we haven't spoken for a while, but we've got this general election coming up, and one of the major things which is not being talked about by any of the major parties are the sorts of things that you look at, which are the major miscarriages of justice, injustices through the courts, things like child stealing by the state, the war on whistleblowers, the child abuse inquiry, this kind of thing is really not featuring hardly anywhere. So first of all, I wonder what you make of the kind of change, really, I suppose, for a lot of people are beginning to realise that there is a focus in the press on specific individuals, people like Harvey Proctor, Jimmy Savile, you know, specific individual, whereas actually it looks like the problem is an institutional one, and the National Child Abuse Inquiry is supposed to be going into this. Do you think that I mean, it's now nearly 4 years since this inquiry was set up. What's the progress? Has there been any progress?
Well, funny you should mention that. I happen to have been with my dear friend and co-founder of the Association of Mackenzie Friends, Belinda, when the snap election was called. And she has now created the Children's Party as a virtual party. I am aware of two people in UKIP who might take on the children's issue. The independent inquiry, I've just looked at their update at their website, because once again, they just are not sufficiently web savvy. You can't even subscribe to their news anywhere. So I don't see what they are doing as much of progress. And in fact, I've identified the power deficiencies that they are suffering from, which are structural, which are institutional, what powers they do and don't have.
Well, look, we've got a major problem with the chair, the most recent chair, Alexis Jay. Lyle Goddard, who was the New Zealand chair, left, saying nothing about why she'd left, effectively being bullied out. But the problem with Alexis Jay is that the inquiry she conducted in Rotherham was, supposedly a success. But the only thing was, there was actually nobody at all in any kind of public position prosecuted as a result of it. And yet what we're really supposed to be looking into is institutional abuse. So she has got a track record of letting the institutional abusers off.
You see, this is what's happening in my case. First, there are crimes, institutionalized. Then there are institutional cover-ups. And then there are institutionalized stitch-ups, which I am one of them. We who are being stitched up are public interest whistleblowers. My friend Yolande, big time, big time, big time. She risks being sectioned right, left and centre. My return to bail date is out, has been prolonged till October 14th. And I still keep three computers in my external disks. I mean, you can't make it up. This real life is much, much stranger than fiction, I can assure you.
Also, I mean, with the general election, what do you make of that? Is there going to be anybody going to be discussing this in the general election campaign? Is there going to be any changes made to the war on whistleblowers?
I doubt it. I always concentrate on the personal as political, you know, what is beyond my sphere of influence. I can't make happen, and that fortunately, the web is our oyster, and the web has more of a memory than the mainstream media. Therefore, I like to play with the web, and I do have this website, nationalinquiry.wordpress.com, where I often reblog from this excellent blog, Researching Reform, which is written by a non-practicing barrister, Natasha Phillips. So, and I'm also often reblogging from Rotherham. There is a very amazing blog called Rotherham Politics, and I reblog from there. So I found that reblogging is a new form of online journalism, and that's how I just sort of spread the word.
This is a bit like, say, on Facebook, sharing or retweeting on Twitter, isn't it? Social media has become really the way people talk to each other. But, of course, we're having to use things like Twitter, Facebook, WordPress, blogs, because the mainstream media, I mean, doesn't seem to be doing its job. I mean, in calling to account, particularly the National Inquiry into child sexual abuse and institutional abuse, we've had a whole series of chairs, none of whom seems to be up to the job, and yet the mainstream press surely should be making sure that there is somebody competent in that job, as well as the government, you know, holding the government to account to make sure somebody is.
Oh, Tony, I have a long ago discovered that the mainstream media are part of the problem and not of the solution. I have been, in my own case, I have been fed by BBC Radio 4, who never told me the title of the program, and they said that they wouldn't misrepresent me after I was very miffed during the interview, and then later I was told by a former BBC employee they will broadcast it anyway because they claim it's in the public interest. You see, from my current perspective...
So what were you... Just tell us about that. Were you smeared by Radio 4?
Smeared is one way of putting it. I felt I was being ridiculed, and I was certainly, I mean, above all else, I don't dare to say that. Well, I suppose I can say that the title was the Satanist cult that never was, and they used me in that program. So it was, you know, completely opposite. They used me to support their opinion. Which, of course, that's why I felt completely misused and abused.
What about the role of the police in all this? Because we do like to think...
Besides the 16 articles that appeared in the local Hammond High. I mean, five of us were mentioned. And besides the WordPress blog, where 40 of us so-called key players are mentioned. And, if you like, online reputation being ruined. I am on the law committee of the British Computer Society, and my committee members has a company to clean up online reputation. So watch this space. I will go after them when the time is right. But policemen, to come back to the police have just not responded to my letter before claim, even though they counted the time should be till May 23rd, but they didn't write. So I now either let it go, or file a judicial review, and or send them a reminder. But meanwhile, I have sent an application for serious case review to the president, Sir James Manby, whose reform I always supported and appreciated. But the problem is, in that, in his case, not institutional, but individual.
So, I mean, if we're aware of some sort of miscarriage of justice child abuse going on, can we go to the police? Can we trust the police?
No, that's the last thing you do. Ian Josephs, who's been observing these cases for 50 years, says that you don't go to police, you don't go to social services, because they are part of the game.
So where do you go?
You go abroad to have your baby, and you go to the web, and you find like-minded victims, and you fight as best as you
now,
can.
Now, I mean, the thing is, of course, you know, I'm sure not all, I know for a fact, not all the police are part of a criminal gang.
Exactly.
What does happen, it does seem to me, and maybe you can corroborate this, is that if it looks like someone who's a powerful paedophile gets... the police investigating them, then they're lent on by the chief constable or the higher ups in the police.
Yes, I've once spoken to a woman who was in human resources in police, and he says it's the people who are higher up who are the corrupt ones, and they are clearly leaning on it. So, you know, that's what the whole system is about. The white collar criminals use the blue collar criminals. The police is as much as used and abused just as prison staff. It's the same thing. Ultimately, a barrister once said to me, it is about intimidation and compliance, and at all and any level.
Now, the Bilderberg conference is going on in the United States with these transatlantic elite, the bankers, the media barons, the oil people, the tech giants all getting together. They're basically a lobby for the NATO expansionism and also for the arms industry in Chantilly, Virginia, just this week. They're talking about this thing called the war on information, and they're worried that the mainstream media is being undermined by the internet. And we've had Theresa May after the Manchester attack also talking about we must clamp down on what people are allowed to say online.
Yes, of course. And this is the thing. Also, Sir James Manby said in a judgment once, the courts need to wake up to the internet and in particular social media. And therefore, they're trying to bring in as many misinformation, disinformation, trolls and shills in. But I have also seen the TED talk by a guy called Juan Bennett, who has created an interplanetary file system, because he says very clearly, it's up to you. Either you want a free web or a controlled one. And it's in the infrastructure of the web. The Googles and YouTubes and Facebooks can only run the web and the net the way they do for because of the current infrastructure. But he's setting up, and I've been to an event where I mentioned this, because somebody also asked, where are the Googles and the YouTubes who are not entering this into the social contract? And these were people who were all talking about digital social innovation. The digital transformation is the sword that divides society, not only into digital illiterate.
If people are concerned about child stealing by the state, which is on the up in Britain, there's been a few MPs helping out with it. Is there any better way to vote in the general election to stop it?
Oh, not yet. It's not on the political agenda. And John Hemming MP he was a Lib Dem. He always said it's policy. And there's nobody who's accountable. And this is for sure. But Len Lawrence, who is a poisoned pilot, who was part of the victim of the Court of Protection, who has really figured out who's who and what's what, and how the Court of Protection is used not only to steal people's assets, but also people's children. He also has been getting a lot of help, both from the military and from the police. And he says they didn't join. They all said they didn't join the force in order to protect child abuse. And they are waking up. But anybody from police also, a UK column broadcast interviews with whistleblowers from the police. They're getting their salaries cut into half and don't get a pension. They are being threatened right, left and centre. You must not blow the whistle.
Amazing. Okay, so maybe the next general election there'll be something about this, but it does seem that the mainstream media really are complicit in not bringing it up. Anyway, Sabine McNeil from Victims Unite, you mentioned some other websites. Do you want to just finish by reminding us whereabouts we can find some of the other stuff you've been doing and other good places online?
Yeah, we who oppose deception.wordpress.com tends to be the place where I put your emails. And nationalinquiry.wordpress.com is about the general national inquiry aspect and the shortcomings of the official inquiry. Because remember, there was a Royal Commission in New South Wales in 1996 already. And that's my recommendation to Sir James Manby, is to start a Royal Commission here.
Good recommendation. Okay, Sabine McNeil, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, occasionally on this show, you'll hear extracts from an incredible interview. He was killed by his own security forces, even though he was an elected president, John F. Kennedy, and his killer, James Files, who was trained by the 82nd Airborne Division, the US Special Forces paratroopers, explains how he got involved with the Chicago Mafia and was sent down to Dallas to kill Kennedy. He also explains this week how President Kennedy would not have been killed if it had been raining, and also how he, the man who shot JFK dead, the CIA, tried to kill him and failed.
Well, when Kennedy come down to Dallas, we had one concern. We feared the limo might have a bubble top, you know, because it never went anywhere without it. And if it's raining, the only thing is we was told in advance that if the top is on, it's a walk away. You know, you board it, you leave it. We'll pick another place. We'll try again. And that would have probably fallen to someone else. But this question had been asked us. How are you going to get through the top? Me, my answer was, you know, using some pretty heavy artillery, like, you know, using one of the old, what do you want to call those things? I got the name on the tip of my tongue.
Armor-piercing?
No, not armor-piercing. One of the rounds for knocking out tanks. Bazookas.
Yeah.
Today we got lost rockets.
Yeah.
But we didn't have lost rockets to run around with back then. That's something new that come down the pike. But anyway, they said, no, they said, we'll do it sensible. But the thing was, they had been instructed they were going to work on his ego. They tried to make Kennedy believe he shouldn't go to Texas, that he should be afraid of Texas. And they worked on his ego, said, you got to use the bubble top. You have to have the top on. You can't sit in an open car. You got to let these, whatever they think, you got to let them think, you know, you're afraid or whatever, but there's a high risk here. You got to have the top on. The more they worked on Kennedy about this, the more he wanted the top off. Kennedy wanted to prove, I'm not scared of anything. I want the top off. I want to wave to the people. I want to see the people. I want to touch the people. So they played on his ego. The top was off.
Were you aware that David Ferry was involved, among many other things, in cancer research?
I did not know David Ferry was involved in anything in cancer research. No, I did not.
Okay, so you got any thoughts about Jack Ruby's cancer? Do you think that was natural or unnatural?
I'm going to say it was injected. There's one thing I want to say. When you talk about David Ferry, for his cancer research, I have no knowledge of that at all. But I do know he liked to play around with hypnosis. I think he used it on a lot of young kids. Because he was in charge of the Civil Air Patrol.
What would you have done if it would be on?
Well, back to the bubble top on the car. If they'd have had the top on, it was a walk-away. But we would have known that before he ever got to the plaza, because we would have been informed if they come out and they picked him up and they got the top on, they're not going to remove the top during the motorcade. Nobody would have been there. None of us would have been on hand to watch John F. Kennedy come down through there, because I could care less about seeing the man. But if the top would have been on, I would have already been on my way back to Mesquite, and I'm quite certain that Mr. Nicoletti and Roselli would have been on their way somewhere else.
So if it would have rained, it was a no-go?
If it was still rain, it was no-go. But when you plan something, all you can do is hope for the best. Like a football, you know, you got to make the play. Seconds are running out. You go for the long one. If it works, it works. It don't. You walk away.
So you acknowledge there was no plan B?
No backup.
There was no backup plan for that. The only backup plan we had for that was if the top is on, it's a no-go.
What has changed in your life in recent years?
I think probably the biggest change in my life is, and let me go back just a little bit further. Before this change took place, I had no emotions or no feelings, basically speaking, for anyone at all. My family never came first. The agency came first. Crime family came first. Everybody was always ahead of my wife and my kids. Wrong, I know that. I know that now. I've got probably a lot of regrets, maybe some remorse for a lot of the things that I did do. I'm sorry at times I wasn't there to see my kids go to their little school plays or do their dances, recitals, or whatever. I'm sorry I wasn't there for their birthdays, for a lot of their Christmases. But those things are part of my life growing up. These are things that I accepted because, to me, other things were more important. My family, my wife, my kids, they were way down on the list of priorities. Wrong, I know. After I got here, when I got here, this place was pretty well wide open. The place was very violent, wild. And, you know, we just recently had several lockdowns due to deaths here. It wasn't natural. But a few years ago, what happened to me was I went to sleep one night. I had a lot of hate in me. I had a lot of anger in me. I had a list of names. Boy, I want to start writing down names, and I want this person, I want that person. A lot of hate in me. But I woke up during the night. I found Jesus sitting by my bunk. A lot of people say, oh, it's a dream. Maybe it was a dream. It's a dream to you, a dream to him. To me, it's real. And I'll ask him, I says, what are you doing here? And he said, I've come to tell you, there's only one way. He said, the Father sent me to tell you. He said, that I'm for real, God is for real, that I'm for real. He says, the only way to the Father is through me. So we talked for a little while. And I went back to sleep. The next morning I woke up, all the hate was gone. I used to wake up and come out of my cell every morning. It's not, what am I going to do today? It's who am I going to have to kill today, or who am I going to have to stab today, or who's going to try to stab me, who I got to fight, you know. Because there have been a lot of fights here, a lot of stabbings. But I had a new feeling in me. I was real light. You know, I felt like I loved everybody. You know, hey, how you doing? Boom. I talked to people I never talked to. I even talked to the cops. Hey, how you doing? What's going on? Hey, nice day. Well, after a little while, I started slipping back again. I got back to being the old Jimmy again. I started getting these angry feelings back, wanting to fight. You know, you look at me the wrong way, I'm going to grab you, slam you into the wall, you know. Whatever you do. I got a second visit. And when I got the second visit from Jesus, it's really got my attention. And at this point, I'd already heard from this one girl, this one lady. I don't know if I should name her on tape or not. But I become romantically involved with her. I fell in love with her. I love her with all my heart. Probably love her more than I've ever loved anything in my life. But we were talking and writing, and she was a good Christian lady, and she had told me a few different things. And so the second visit I got, Jesus told me to get my life in order. The Father was going to call me home. I thought, well, Jesus, I'm going to die. And I'm going to die right away. And so I told her on the phone. So she was crying a little bit. You know, I was a little sad over, you know, this and that. But then I was reading in the Bible, and I was reading in Matthew chapter 24 about the earth giving the birth pains and all this. What God was telling me, Jesus was telling me, God's not calling me home this stage of the game, but be prepared. Get ready for heaven so I can have a life hereafter. And I'm reading all about this in Matthew. And then it struck on me what it was. So I called her up and I told her. And so, but like I say, since then, I've lived a whole different life here. I used a few words of profanity in this interview strictly for the reason of what was said. There was actual words verbatim. But when I'm not in this interview, I try not to use vulgar language. I try not to hate people. I try to maintain good thoughts. But in here, that's hard to maintain good thoughts. Very hard in here. But I work at it very hard. And I pray every night, every day. I don't run around with my Bible. I don't run around trying to tell you all about the Word of God. That's not my job. You want to hear about it, I'll be more than happy to sit down and talk to you about it. But I don't try to push it on anybody. We have a lot of different kinds of religions here.
Why, briefly tell me why you're in prison right now.
I'm in prison for a specific reason. When I come out of the federal prison, I did a federal stretch and I was out for a little while. People started trying to kill me. When they started trying to kill me the first time, I was at along Quentin Road and Rollins Road in Round Lake Beach, shortly past midnight, driving a little Chevy Chevette. And the cops had been harassing me there. They knew who I was. Every time they see me, they'd handcuff me, get me out of the car, and my papers blow out, they'd throw all my stuff down the street. So this particular night, I pull up the stoplight there. I'm on Quentin Road, fixing to make a right-hand turn on Rollins Road. I'm staying with my aunt and uncle at this time. They're about 2 blocks down from there. I looked up in the rearview mirror, and I seen a car pulling up behind me with no lights in the next lane. And I thought, shit, it's cops again. You know, I'm going to get hassled again. It's not a squad car number, but I just figured it's detectives, you know. As it pulls up alongside of me, I'm looking in the mirror sitting by the door, the little door mirror on the side, and I see an SMG come up. What anybody don't know that is, it's a small machine gun, automatic weapon. As I see it coming out of the window, I roll across the seat, hit the door, hit the ground, roll back up against the rocker panel of the car. They put 30 holes in my car. Full clip they put into it. As they were pulling away, I come up off the ground with my piece, and I got off about 4 rounds. I'm on federal parole at that point. I'm not supposed to be carrying a weapon, but you never find me without a weapon. I got off 4 rounds, took the back window out. They kept going. I jumped back in my car, took a right on the Rollins Road, went down to Grove Avenue, pulled into the house at my aunt and uncle's at 1620 Grove, went in there and got the tarp from my uncle out of the garage and put it over the car so they couldn't see the bullet holes. That was the first attempt on my life.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and download the podcast the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Laura Welty, who was interviewed by Arabella Wynn, also Sabine McNeil and James Files, the killer of John F. Kennedy, the US president, back in 1963. An incredible interview. About time the BBC broadcast that one, I think. Also thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. That's on 0117 909 6897 or email prsc.org.uk. also via the National Volunteering website. Lots of volunteer opportunities on there, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stage. You know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out. I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far. Cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. A crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of garbage pails, used to be a fag hag. Such a dance to tango, skipped the life and tango. A zircon princess seemed to lost her senses. Down at the peep show, watching all the creeps, so she could tell her stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so diddy, she had to get a pimp, she couldn't make it on her own. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My brother's doing fast on my mother's TV. Says she watches too much, it's just not healthy. All my children in the daytime, Dallas at night. Can't even see the game or the Sugar Ray fight. The bill collectors, they ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bum education, double-digit inflation. Can't take the train to the job, there's a strike at the station. Me on King Kong, standing on my back, can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac, a mid-range migraine, cancer membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane, I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me, call, I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My son said, Daddy, I don't wanna go to school, cause the teacher's a jerk, he must think I'm a fool. And all the kids smoke reefer, I think it'd be cheaper if I just got a job, learn to be a street sweeper. I dance to the beat, shuffle my feet, wear a shirt and tie, and run with the creeps. Cause it's all about money, ain't a damn thing funny. You got to have a con in this land of milk and honey. They pushed that girl in front of the train, took her to the doctor, sewed her arm on the gang. Stabbed that man right in his heart, gave him a transplant for a brand new start. I can't walk through the park cause it's crazy after dark. Keep my hand on my gun cause they got me on the run. I feel like an outlaw, broke my last glass jaw. Hear them say, you want some more? Living on a seesaw. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. Say what? It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. A child is born with no state of mind, blind to the ways of mankind. God is smiling on you, but he's frowning too, because only God knows what you'll go through. You'll grow in the ghetto, living second rate, and your eyes will sing a song of deep hate. The places you play and where you stay looks like one great big alleyway. You'll admire all the number book takers, thugs, pimps, and pushers, and the big money makers. Driving big cars, spending 20s and 10s, and you want to grow up to be just like them. Smugglers, scramblers, burglars, gamblers, pickpocket peddlers, even panhandlers. You say I'm cool, I'm no fool, but then you wind up dropping out of high school. Now you're unemployed, all non-void, walking around like your pretty boy Floyd. Turned stick-up kid, but look what you done did. Got sent up for an 8-year bid. Now your manhood is took and you're a Maytag. Spend the next 2 years as an undercover fag, being used and abused to serve like hell, till one day you was found hung dead in a cell. It was plain to see that your life was lost. You was cold and your body swung back and forth. But now your eyes sing the sad, sad song of how you live so fast and die so young. So don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Yo, Mel, you see that girl, man?
Yeah, man.
Yo, that sound like Cowboy,
what's
man.
Up, fool?
Yo, what's up, money?
Yo.
Hey, where's Creole and Raheem, man?
They upstairs cooling out.
So what's up for tonight, y'all?
Yo, we can go down to the fever, man.
Go check out Junebug, man.
Hey, yo, you know that girl Betty?
Yeah, man.
My mom got robbed, man.
Not
what?
Again,
she got hurt
bad. What
the
hell?
What's going on? Free! Don't nobody move nothing. Y'all know what this is. Get him up.
Yo, man, we down with Grandmaster Flash and the